The politics of longevity and the need for global action against evil ageism are much discussed on The Big Middle with me, Susan Florey. Across the life course of this podcast, 8 months and counting, the big issues of the longevity revolution are examined by some of the brightest thinkers around. This time, we're going deep into a literary art form I guarantee will excite your imagination and soothe your midlife soul. We're exploring the power and beauty of poetry about aging. Of course, poetry was never a feature of my life in broadcast news. I'm appreciating it anew now, and that's all down to my guest, an intrepid explorer of nature and people, an aesthete of many layers. Adrian Jurek, hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. You are up with the hummingbirds because, of course, you are, what, are you looking out at Okanagan Lake from the coast, the west coast of Canada?
I am indeed. It's 6:30 in the morning here, and I'm looking out over the mountains and over Okanagan Lake, and the sun is just bathing things in a morning glow, and it's lovely.
Are all the forecasts that you're going to have a hot summer? Because that part of the world, it sizzles in summer, doesn't it?
It does. We have a problem here with fires now regularly in the summer. So they call it. The name, unfortunately, is changing from the Okanagan to the Smokanagan because of the chronic forest fire problem that we have here.
What a shame. All those majestic Douglas firs.
Yes, it is. It's glorious. It's a privilege to be here. It's a privilege to be back in Canada again.
Before we get into the poetry that you've set up for us, I'm very excited about this. You've been an intrepid traveler. You've done what where over recent years?
I have spent most of my life as an international school educator abroad, and I've worked pretty much on every continent over the course of my career as an international school teacher, and have come back to Canada periodically for short stints, but I am a bit of a global nomad and have spent most of my adult life abroad. And again, coming back here is a wonderful return home. But yes, I would say that most of my life has been abroad, yeah.
It's been a wonderful playground for you and a professional backdrop for you because you've become a filmmaker and you do nature hikes. You use poetry during these hikes to tap into some of the existential anxiety that people in midlife are experiencing.
Yes, it's poetry I've discovered is a wonderful tool. It's a lens through which to understand aging, midlife transition. The poets have a way of calling forth things that we already know at some level, kind of inarticulate knowings that we already have within us. And nature does the same thing. The landscape does the same thing. There's deep teaching by way of metaphor out on the landscape. When the two in tandem really call forth understanding from within, I've discovered that really is reassuring and really is deeply soothing for people. And a weekend away of walking in the hills and in the rainforests, the temperate rainforests of the coastal area of British Columbia here, a weekend of that really tends to reset people and leave them feeling much more relaxed and at home in the world and in themselves and in what's happening within them.
Well, let's get some of that relaxation and reassurance going for us now. What's the first poem that you've chosen for us?
The first poem is a poem by a poet writer named Jeanette Encinias, Beneath the Sweater and the Skin. And it is a lovely tribute to aging that I absolutely adore. And I think I'll just read this for you just so that you can hear the cadence and the meaning in this. How many years of beauty do I have left? She asks me. How many more do you want? Here is 34. Here is 50. When you are 80 years old and your beauty rises in ways your cells cannot even imagine now, and your wild bones grow luminous and ripe, having carried the weight of a passionate life, when your hair is aflame with winter and you have decades of learning and leaving and loving sewn into the corners of your eyes, and your children come home to find their own history in your face, when you know what it feels like to fail ferociously and have gained the capacity to rise and rise and rise again, when you can make your tea on a quiet and ridiculously lonely afternoon and still have a song in your heart, queen owl beating beneath the cotton of your sweater. Because your beauty began there, beneath the sweater and the skin, remember? This is when I will take you into my arms and coo, you brave and glorious thing. You've come so far. I see you. Your beauty is breathtaking.
Oh, I just have goosebumps. That is fantastic. I kept thinking, oh, that's my favorite bit. And then you'd keep going, oh, that's my favorite one. I did love the line, you have decades of learning and leaving and loving sewn into the corners of your eyes. It's just heart-wrenchingly beautiful, so eloquent, so beautiful. Tell me about Jeanette. Is it Encinias? She's an American poet, yes?
She is. She is from Portland, Oregon. She's a prolific poet. She's got a wonderful collection of poetry on her website. She's also a memoirist and does some coaching and writing as well.
And what about you, Adrian? What touched you the most from Beneath the Sweater and the Skin?
There's just such a deep sense of homecoming and a deep sense of welcoming back. This, you know, life is so much about the long journey out and then the long journey back home. And this poet, the last piece, this is when I will take you into my arms and coo, you brave and glorious thing. You've come so far. I work with children, and it's deeply reassuring to a child to be reassured about their bravery. And it's something that no matter how old we are, we want to be held. We want to be reassured. You've done such wonderful things. You've come so far. And I think all of us, no matter how old, we want that reassurance that, boy, you've been on quite a journey, haven't you? And look at what you've done. You've done wonderful things.
I love the lines where she says, and your children come home to find their own history in your face.
That's right. That's right. And then the whole beauty of the it's a whole, it just runs contrary to our conventional notions of beauty. And that beauty is in the wrinkles and in the aging and in the history. And it's celebrating that fact. It really is not seen in contemporary society.
Well, this is what we're trying to do, isn't it, with the big middle, talking about trying to shift mindsets so that it is more visible, this degree of beauty, this depth of life experience, which can be found in the faces of everyone who's lived a certain number of years. Now, mm-hmm. You mentioned you work with children. For now, it's your day job, and you've been an educator. You've traveled the world with that. What are you doing now?
Well, I work in the field of counseling psychology. I work with children in public education, and I work with children in private practice as a counselor as well. One of the things that's of course with children these days, and it's always been the case, anxiety is a problem with children, and it interferes with their lives and their academic scholastic achievement. But it's something that I work with a great deal with children, and it really is. So much of what I do with children, so much of what I do with adults in private practice is just reassuring that this too shall pass. This is a normal thing to be feeling at this time and in these circumstances, and this will pass. And I find it a delight to work with children because they really do respond well to my interventions. And there really is a joy and a delight in them that's infectious and that's contagious. And so I get something back as well from that.
And do you use poetry to connect with them as well?
I use story, which is in fact the same effect as poetry. But children, of course, respond to story. There's something ancient about the power of a story, and adults as well. But adults, I tend to find poetry appeals to adults a little bit more.
What poem about aging have you lined up for us next, Adrian?
The next piece that I have is a piece by Mary Oliver, an American poet, quite possibly one of the most well-known poets, recently passed away. The poem is called The Messenger. My work is loving the world. Here, the sunflowers. There, the hummingbird. Equal seekers of sweetness. Here, the quickening yeast. There, the blue plums. Here, the clam deep in the speckled sand. Are my boots old? Is my coat torn? Am I no longer young and still not half perfect? Let me keep my mind on what matters, which is my work, which is mostly standing still and learning to be astonished. The Phoebe, the Delphinium, the sheep in the pasture, and the pasture, which is mostly rejoicing, since all ingredients are here. Which is gratitude, to be given a mind and a heart, and these body clothes, a mouth with which to give shouts of joy, to the mouth and the wren, to the sleepy dug-up clam, telling them all over and over how it is that we live forever.
I love that. What's it called again? I got lost in it and I forgot the title.
The poem is called The Messenger, and I've chosen it. There's a stanza in the middle. Are my boots old? Is my coat torn? Am I no longer young and still not half perfect? She really just sort of brushes aside this notion that the physical aspects of aging are not important. What is important is the quality of attention that you bring to the world. She's celebrating that her task and her work in the world is really standing still and being astonished, and just noticing the world around her. And she celebrates that in her poetry. She's continually paying deep attention to nature, to the natural world.
And these are lessons we can all take on board, to live in the moment and observe. You know, get your heads up, look around you.
Indeed. And that's one of her instructions for living. She's got a short piece of writing. She says, these are the instructions for living. Number one, pay attention. Number two, be astonished. Number three, tell about it. Those are her instructions for living. And I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a more succinct set of instructions for living. It really is about being attentive to the everyday, to the things that are around us every day.
And is she the one that you constantly go back to, you dip into her output, her prolific output, in order to guide yourself? I mean, of a morning, you have so many poems at your beck and call. I know, because we've had epic conversations, Adrian. We just should, you know, backfill a bit. I met you through this podcast. You put on my website one of the most beautiful reviews I've had, born of the conversation I had with Jonathan Rauch, the journalist for The Atlantic and the one who wrote the book, The Happiness Curve. I smiled for weeks. And of course, just thinking about it privately, it was just such a lovely review. And then our first phone call of many, it lasted about 6 or 7 hours. It was epic.
Yes. Well, I had to say something. In the podcasting universe, I had yet to find an interview that was that thoughtful and with the questioning that was that incisive in tandem and coupled with sort of this really exquisite listening ability that I think you have, and this understanding of silence and how to use it in an interview. I thought that was really rich, and I think
that's what spoke to me the most, because everyone knows I'm an accomplished chatterbox.
Yeah.
So I was just wearing your review in my mind going, wow, so he thinks I listen really well. That's really lovely. But the thing is, over the course of many hours of chatting on the phone, the first of many conversations, I mean, the poetry that enters your language and then my brain expands, my brain gets into my soul and is ever soothing. Is your nose always in a book of poems?
Yes, it almost always is. I'm afraid I've been exposed to it by a dear friend. Becky Livingston is a writer friend of mine. And then also going on walking tour with the poet David White, it opened up an entire universe that I had not even known about before. And really, ever since then, I found it very instructive. In my own sort of midlife passage, I found that poetry is the perfect guide and the perfect lighthouse that's been a beacon for me, and I'm constantly looking for and sensitive to a good line of poetry. The right line and the right question from the right poet can really take you through your life. So that's my thought on it.
Well, you are like a lighthouse keeper, because in our conversations, I've said a half phrase or I've mulled something and you've got the perfect companion poem to illustrate or to suggest an answer.
Yeah, and I really don't know. It's hard to know. Poets have been there. Freud, I think, was heard to have said once that wherever I go, I find a poet has been there before me. And I find that that's remarkable. I find that that any book of psychology could be condensed down. I mean, the poets have done it before. They've done it in a stanza. What it's taken an entire textbook of psychology to say a poet has done in a stanza. And I find for the nomadic global life that I lead, a stanza of poetry folded up and tucked in my front shirt pocket is far more portable and far more useful to me. That's what I've discovered.
And is that what you're packing on your travels? Do you always have something like that, if it's not to mind, because your mind is a treasure chest of so many great poets, but do you always have something scratched out on a little piece of paper that you can fold away and bring out and draw inspiration from?
It's almost never written down, Susan. It's almost always just memorized. I run across something and I can't help but memorize it, and I cannot put it down. We are just temporary holders of poetry, and I guess my feeling is that it's something that sort of it comes upon. It's something that crosses my path. I memorize it. I pass it on to someone else, and they take it and do what they need to do with it. So I almost never have it written, to answer your question. It's almost something I can't help but memorize. And
well, thank you for opening the door to the world of poetry for me, because I'd long since closed. It was always about facts and figures and knowing the face of whomever is the newsmaker of the moment. So this has been really wonderful. So let's get back to our poems about aging. And the next one, you told me about the poet Fleur Adcock, the poem Weathering, and absolutely sublime. Tell us about this poem before I hit play on the recording I've dug up of it.
This is a poem that I was introduced to by David White, by the poet David White. I had heard him read this years ago. And the poem is titled Weathering. And she's a New Zealand poet. And it's set up on the landscape. It's set up on the fells and on the moors in England. And it's just redolent with the imagery of and the walking that you can do up in that country. So she's just a wonderful example of someone who's celebrating aging. She speaks in an age-defying way that is just so inspirational, and I just found that I had to memorize it. And I guess I'm thanking David White for bringing that poem to my attention.
All right, fantastic. Let's have a listen now to it.
Literally thin-skinned, I suppose. My face catches the wind off the snow line and flushes with a flush that will never wholly settle. Well, that was a metropolitan vanity, wanting to look young forever, to pass. I was never a pre-Raphaelite beauty, nor anything but pretty enough to satisfy men who need to be seen with passable women. But now that I'm in love with a place which doesn't care how I look or if I'm happy, happy is how I look, and that's all. My hair will turn grey in any case, my nails chip and flake, my waist thicken, and the years work all their usual changes. If my face is to be weather-beaten as well, that's little enough lost. A fair bargain for a year among lakes and fells, when simply to look out of my window at the high pass makes me indifferent to mirrors and to what my soul may wear over its new complexion.
Oh, that's just glorious. I love how it's an ode to how you grow indifferent to mirrors and to what your soul may wear over its new complexion. That is absolutely wonderful. What's your favorite line in this one, Adrian, if you can pick from such a feast?
Yes. Well, the last stanza, a fair bargain for a year among the lakes and fells. Really, it's this instant idea that, yeah, what a bargain. She's enjoying so much her time up in the outdoors, in the lakes and the fells. And she's wondering, you know, if I've had to pay a price, what a small price to have paid to be able to be out here on this landscape, in the world, in the real world, in the world of nature. To me, that speaks to me so powerfully because the opportunity to be outside and outdoors is real and it's grounding. And it reminds you of what is true and what is important.
When you go on your treks with people who are in midlife transition and mulling what next and raising some existential questions, perhaps a little bewildered about how their life has played out, is this one of the poems that you share with them?
Yes, this is one among many. And oftentimes, not the entire poem, but simply a stanza from a poem like this, or a stanza or a line from Mary Oliver. In tandem with the right setting in the right forest glade, or, you know, standing before the right nurse log, the right line of poetry and the right place in nature, they often work in tandem very, very powerfully together. They're quite complementary. So yes, this is one of the pieces among many others that I'll often recite just as we're standing before something interesting and outside in the world.
Yeah, I love when she said, but now that I am in love with a place which doesn't care how I look or if I'm happy, happy is how I look, and that's all.
That's right. It's finally this liberation, this freedom that she's speaking of from what society deems to be beautiful and what society deems to be necessary to be happy. She's speaking to the sense of liberation that finally she's freed from that, from servitude to that idea, and is being grounded and reconnected, I suppose you could call it, to source, where she's come from, where we all come from, which is the landscape. And how deeply reassuring to be liberated and to find home, which is, again, what poetry is about. The deep purpose of poetry is to help us find our way back home.
All righty. Well, who else is going to take us home? Who else have you lined up?
There's a West Indian poet by the name of Derek Walcott. He's got a poem called Love After Love. This is one of his shorter pieces. He's got quite long pieces, but Love After Love is again about homecoming. It's about this journey in life that we take through different identities, different masks, different roles, but that ultimately what we all yearn to do is to come home and be greeted and welcomed home and to sit and be it, feel at home. So this is Love After Love. The time will come when with elation you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile in the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit, feast on your life.
Feast on your life. Oh, more shivers.
Indeed.
And I don't summon them up. It's just so natural, so powerful. Gosh, poetry, music, beautiful.
I have to say that one of the joys of poetry, it's almost like working with children or working in a helping capacity, is that we really are reminded that we're all trying to come back home and we're all trying to be seen for who we once were. And the poets, they're trying to do this. And I think Derek Walcott is trying to remind us that, you will love again the stranger who was yourself. You will finally come back to yourself and allow yourself to just be who you've always been in some sense. And I guess I really appreciate that. As someone who does counseling and as someone who leads people out onto landscape, it's all that we really want. It's just, to come back home.
Absolutely. Now, you are surrendering your home, your temporary home in Kelowna for a little while. You're starting a new chapter of your life as a traveling filmmaker. Tell us about this.
Yes, I'm leaving the life of counseling and of working with children to begin work as an itinerant filmmaker. I've discovered the camera is a tool. It's a wonderful tool for capturing unspoken truth that people simply have within them, capturing and reflecting it back to them. So what I do is I travel to sit with people and to listen to them as they tell their stories. And I capture the hour-long story that they speak in front of the camera, and I distill it back and I give it back to them and say, here is a short distilled version of you speaking to yourself. And quite often it's quite revelatory for people to be given a film of themselves. They're quite surprised at the places in the film where their eyebrows will arch, or where they will have a sudden intake of breath, or where they will lean forward, or where their hands will begin to become animated. And in that instant, they will realize what it is that they're truly passionate about, what it is that they've always known, but simply have never spoken out loud before.
Your output is really moving. And it is just the person speaking to camera. You've cut out your catalytic questions that get them to examine themselves.
Yes, I have. I've deliberately stripped down. It's a technique that I saw modeled by Nick Askew, who's an American filmmaker, originally from the UK. And yes, it is a stripped down black background very often, not always. But the intent is to eliminate distraction and to focus in really on the eyes and on the voice, and to really capture what it is, the words that are trying to really to come forth. So it's very, very simple, but it's also very, very profound. What I'm trying to do is arrange a conversation between the person and an older part of themselves, a more original, more authentic part of themselves that has waited in some cases for years to be heard.
So it's filmmaking as therapy. It's a form of therapy because you've got to expose your vulnerabilities.
It is. It's a wonderful form. I suppose it is a therapeutic. The intent is not therapeutic, but the outcome often is, the feeling often is. And it really is. There aren't any directions. There's no need to go anywhere in particular. But it really is the case that I find that when people are offered a chance to sit and to take control of the direction of a conversation, and not to be interrupted, but simply to go with whatever thought is foremost on their mind, it really is liberating for people. I've experienced it myself. I've often sat in front of the camera, in front of Nick Askew's camera, and I've had something in mind, something I want to say. I had some point to make. But when I've run out of the things that I had planned to say, then what's left are the things that have been waiting in the background, quite deeply in the background, that have yearned to be spoken out loud.
And wow, so it all comes bubbling up.
It really does. It really is. It's remarkable. There are things within us that don't get a chance to have any airtime, quite frankly, in the sort of the busyness of everyday life and in social media. We do keep ourselves so busy that we really don't have much true contact with the feelings and the thoughts that are quite deep within us. And I'm finding that the camera is quite good that way, and that there isn't any leading, and there's no direction that needs to go in particular, but it's a remarkable experience. And it's and once people get used to the idea, and once they truly relax into it, then it's almost impossible to switch off. I've sat for hours where people have just decided that this is a wonderful thing and I can trust this. And they've gone quite deep and really revealed things to themselves that they didn't know they knew. I do find it quite gratifying.
Well, I love how you describe it on your website. You help people become more visible to themselves.
It's a question of being seen. And it's what we're all trying to do is we're all fundamentally looking to be seen in the world, not only in the world, but seen by ourselves. We're looking to be heard by ourselves. There are words that when we say them spontaneously out loud, we suddenly recognize them as truth. We suddenly recognize them as words we've been struggling to articulate maybe for years. And that moment of release is a moment of real, I find, real epiphany sometimes. And it's liberating. And I quite enjoy that. I've had that experience myself, and I'm quite enjoying doing that work on camera with people. Whatever their initial intent might have been, to give a film of a person back to themselves is a deep form of service in the world that I quite enjoy.
Well, fantastic. And so you're on the road as of when school's out in July. And where first? And you're for hire as well. Your website, adrianjurek.com, and you can see a beautiful gallery there of all of the kind of thing that you do. Where are you going in July and for the next several months?
Well, in July, I'm hoping to go down to Washington, D.C., hopefully down to interview Elizabeth White. I heard her on your podcast, your interview with her, and I was just stunned by her vulnerability and the quality of your conversation with her. I just thought I have to meet with this person and see if she would be interested in being filmed. And then, of course, in August, I've got a few other people lined up in Ontario and in the East Coast of Canada as well.
You can go through my roster of amazing podcast guests.
Yeah.
Why not? They all have so many layers to discover, like Elizabeth White.
Your podcast, Susan, has been pretty great for introducing me to a lot of interesting people. I've met, Chip Conley. I've gone down to the Modern Elder Academy. I've done some filming with him. So that's been wonderful. And I guess I'll keep listening to your podcast to see who else I might want to interview next.
I think Jonathan Rauch. He's in D.C., so you can line him up as well. He'd be fascinating. And yeah, fantastic guy. He'd probably be up for it, but you might have to take a ticket because he's pretty busy. Like all of the guests, they're pretty busy. Let's get back to the poetry about aging. Who have you got for us next?
William Butler Yeats. And the poem is an old one that's well known to many. It's called Sailing to Byzantium. This is a piece that I heard recited by the Jungian analyst Marianne Woodman. She recited it in a voice that I won't begin to try to duplicate, but it's just rich. It goes like this, the second verse. An aged man is but a paltry thing, a tattered coat upon a stick, unless soul clap its hands and sing and louder sing. It's a phenomenal celebration of the difference that it can make when you decide at midlife not to believe in the narrative, when you decide to reject the story that is handed to you and the script that is handed to you at midlife about what it means to be 55 or 60 or 65. And you decide to clap your hands and let your soul sing and louder sing. It's an utterly defiant and utterly subversive way of coming back at the world that I think Yeats came up with here in this piece in the second verse. And I just love it. And I think...
And when would that have been?
Well, this would have been I'm in the 18th century, this piece would have been written.
A little bit of subversion goes a long way, doesn't it, Adrian?
Indeed.
We all have to be subversive and reject the cultural messages that sideline a lot of people and get us all a little bit bewildered about where our place is in the world after halftime.
It is indeed. It is about soul clapping its hands and singing. Your podcast is a perfect example of the people who are deciding to clap their hands and sing and louder sing and have a second and a third act. And so I guess I'm really just enchanted by what Yeats is saying here.
Fantastic. It's amazing how all of this travels so well over the centuries.
Indeed.
I mean, we could go back to Cicero. We could go back to Socrates. We could go on forever.
Yeah.
We're going to wind this up now, Adrian. Have you got one more for us?
Yes, I've got a last little four lines from Mary Oliver.
We can never have too much Mary Oliver.
Okay. And again, there's something about her that is, I find, subversive and I find defiant. She speaks out against about the notion of being good and in following conventions and following scripts and in following what society tells us we need to be at a certain age. You do not have to be good, she says. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves.
Oh, precious. I can't thank you enough for introducing me to Mary Oliver and, of course, the others. But, oh, that is sublime. So beautiful. Just fabulous. And she died a couple of months ago, was it?
Yes, it was not long ago. And, you know, much to the disappointment of all of us, she was a leader, I would say, of the big middle. She was a leader, you know, someone into her 80s who spoke out through her poetry, who spoke in favor of life and attention and gratitude. So a real champion, a real standard bearer. But certainly somebody whose words I will continue to follow, and somebody who the world continues to learn from every day. Every time you read her poetry, it's a guide, it's a lighthouse. She's a beacon to us all, I find.
Adrian Jurek, man of nature, poetry, and film, a beacon if ever there was one, a beautiful soul by every possible measure. Thank you for growing our minds in this episode of The Big Middle. Our minds, our hearts, feeding our souls, Adrian. And thank you for your friendship. We're going to be friends for a long time.
We are. Thank you, Susan, for having me.
As ever, links to all in the show notes. You can find The Big Middle on my website, susanflory.com, and Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, everywhere, really. I mostly hang out on Twitter these days, seldom on Facebook, it seems. At The Big Middle Pod is my handle. But of course, my nose heretofore forevermore is going to be more and more in poetry books. You too? Until the next one, thanks for your company. Bye-bye.